Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello and welcome to Coppola Connections, the podcast where I'm trying to find out, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time? And the way I intend to do that is to shake every single branch of the family's filmography to find out the answer to that question. On the last episode, I was joined by Helen O'Hara to talk about 2001's The Princess Diaries. This week, we're skipping forward 3 years to look at 2004's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, directed by Wes Anderson. And to join me on this deep sea adventure is George McGee of the Retro Ramble podcast. Be thinking to yourself, hang on a second, Petros, it is Tuesday. What are episodes doing dropping on a Tuesday? Well, if you didn't see the post on social media or heard the little PSA I left at the end of last episode, this is the new normal, ladies and gentlemen. Episodes will be released on Tuesdays from here on out. There is a reason behind it, but it's very boring. As is always the case on this podcast, we will be doing a deep search into this film. There will be no stone unturned. There will be no jaguar shark unhunted as we look at this film, so there'll be spoilers aplenty. If you'd like to find out if and where this film is streaming, do be sure to check out a handy little document in the show notes. Unfortunately, there isn't any Patreon bonus content for this episode. However, one thing I would like you to do is head on over to cagedinpodcast.limitedrun.com to pick up either a pack of pins or one of the prints that are on sale, because at the moment, a high percentage of the proceeds from all of that is going towards charitable donations to Women's Aid and Refuge. So all that's left to do is to stick on some Bowie, your Adidas Zissous and a red beanie as we make some Coppola connections.
Supposedly Cousteau and his cronies invented the idea of putting walkie-talkies into the helmet. But we made ours with a special rabbit ear on the top so we could pipe in some music.
The Belafonte, home to Team Zissou. Skilled crew of deep sea divers, adventurers, documentary filmmakers.
Action!
Led by internationally renowned oceanographer Captain Steve Zissou, expert on every aspect of marine life.
Swamp leeches, everybody! Check for swamp leeches. Nobody else got hit? I'm the only one? What's the deal?
But there remains one form of life about which Captain Zissou knows very little.
You're supposed to be my son, right?
I want you on Team Zissou.
The answer's yes.
Well, it's got to be. I'll order you a red cap and a Speedo.
Ho! Oh!
This will be Team Zissou's most ambitious adventure to date. I'm going to go on an overnight drunk, and in 10 days, I'm going to set out to find the shark that ate my friend and destroy it.
What would be the scientific purpose of killing it?
Revenge.
You must swear, legally swear, that you'll not kill that shark.
Split into two groups. I'll take Ned, Ogata, and Wolodarski.
Thanks. Thanks a lot for not picking me.
We're being led on an illegal suicide mission.
I'm gonna fight you, Steve.
You never say, I'm gonna fight you, Steve. You just smile and act natural,
And then you sucker punch him.
Action.
Are you finding what you were looking for out here with me? I hope so. Quiet out there tonight. Can you hear the jack whale singing?
Beautiful. I wonder what they're saying.
Well, that was the sludge tanker over there, but there you go.
2004, we saw Jason Schwartzman and his mother Talia Shire in I Heart Huckabees. John Schwartzman was the DOP for Meet the Fockers, and Nicolas Cage stole the Declaration of Independence in National Treasure. Elsewhere, we saw the release of Roman Coppola's first film with Wes Anderson, acting as second unit director on the focus of this week's episode, the adventure comedy drama The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou. To join me in my search for the mythic Jaguar shark and hopping aboard the good ship Belafonte, with me is the new recruit and unpaid intern to Team Coppola Connections, Retro Ramble podcast host George McGee. How are you, George?
I'm good, thanks, Petros. Thank you for having me.
It's all my pleasure. So, before we get talking about the Coppola family, tell us a little bit about Retro Ramble. What is it you guys do over on that podcast?
So Retro Ramble is a podcast that my brother Charlie and I do, and it's essentially us revisiting the films that we grew up with. So mainly the sort of blockbusters of the 80s and 90s. So that could be anything from, you know, classic things like Goonies, Back to the Future, to, you know, action classics, Predator, Commando, Die Hard, Speed, Aliens, that sort of thing. So yeah, it's usually 80s and 90s, but it's a chance for us to go back and say, what made those films so great? Do they still hold up? A lot of them are still part of franchises or have been remade, so it's seeing how they stack up today. So, and yeah, it's just a good way of Charlie and I staying in touch and just chatting about films.
Perfect, man. It's always great, and it's great to see that there's a couple of Nicolas Cage films in there. I've listened to your episodes on The Rock and Face Off, I believe. No, Con Air.
Yeah. So we've done that Holy Trinity, that action trilogy. I think Face Off was actually the first episode we did. So we did Face Off and Air Force One as like our first episode. And I'm sure you're the same, or any podcast is the same. You're sort of a little bit, you know, you cringe a bit when you think back to your first episode. So in my mind, I'm quite tempted to redo Face Off again, like a remake of sorts. But yeah, we've done them. Yeah, were they all in the same year? Was it all 97? Or it might be 97 to 98. So you've got the Rock. No, Rock's 96. Face Off's 97.
97. Because yeah. There's a ridiculous overlap between Con Air and Face Off filming. And I think it was like they came out within like a 3-month window. So like I can just only imagine what the summer of 97 would have been like. It's like you get that kind of assault of that ramshackle team in Con Air. And then next thing you know, you've got Cage and Travolta facing off in Face Off. It's like, fucking hell.
So yes, I say we've done the action trilogy for Cage, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the testosterone trilogy is what I've coined it here on Caged In. So let's talk about the Coppola family. When did you first become aware of them? Was there a specific person, or when did you become aware of them as like an entity?
It does all start with Francis Ford Coppola. Coppola, let's call the whole thing off. So yeah, I mean, I have always been a bit of a film geek. I probably started reading Empire magazine when I was about 14, something like that. So obviously, you know, you become aware of the classics, you know, like Godfather. And I think that was it. You know, it seemed a bit weird. I mean, I don't know if it was the same for you, but it seemed like there was a bit of a craze in the sort of mid to late 90s about gangster films. Like all the rappers were really into them. So like Scarface, Goodfellas, The Godfather, and everyone had the posters. And I remember some of my mates had the posters, but hadn't even seen the films.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, the Godfather poster is, you know, it's iconic, isn't it? So, and it is, you know, one of those things on like a bit like Pulp Fiction on many students' bedroom, you know, walls and things like that. So, yeah, I think it all stems back with him. But obviously, yeah, the more I read, then you hear about more of the connections. So, and obviously I read, oh, it's probably a long time ago now, but I read Easy Rider's Raging Bulls, which is a fantastic book. So I knew about him as the, are they the movie brats? Like him, the movie Spielberg? Brats,
yeah.
Yeah, Lucas De Palma and Scorsese. And then, yeah, you just sort of, through being a film geek, you read about the connection. So in terms of, I think at that point, obviously, Sofia Coppola was just known as the bad actress in Godfather 3. And yeah, I knew the Talia Shire connection. And I don't think I immediately knew that Nick Cage was a Coppola. But yeah, I did know that. And then, yeah, sort of, it kind of all sort of expanded from there. So yeah, it all started with Francis. But yeah, I'm a big fan of the other connections as well.
Yeah, they're a fascinating family in the fact that there is this kind of, they have a little bit of something for everyone. So it's like, you've got your, I don't know, Nicolas Cage is almost like a genre unto himself. And then...
Yes, he is.
You've got, yeah.
But saying that, you know, Francis Ford Coppola has done some really diverse films, hasn't he?
Yeah, that is the thing. And I think it's that four-film run in the 70s, everybody holds up. And then everything else, they kind of don't really look at. And there's like some really interesting and great stuff within there. I think like that double like run of The Outsiders and Rumblefish in the 80s is fantastic.
I can't see it like that's something Charlie and I have talked about maybe doing as a feature for our podcast for like classic films that we haven't got around to seeing, and The Outsiders is one of them because that's got so many people in that in their like one of their first films, isn't it? You know, it's all so many iconic 80s actors.
Yeah, so yeah, you got like Ralph Macchio, you got
Cruise,
yeah, before he got his teeth done.
Yeah. So yeah, I haven't actually seen Outsiders or Rumblefish, but yeah, they're sort of on my to watch list at some point.
Well, perfect. I would if you take anything away from this podcast, that's a recommend from me, those two.
So the Coppola connection for this time around, is it Roman Coppola?
So yeah, this would have been Roman Coppola acted as second unit director on this film.
So I have to admit, actually, I hadn't heard of Roman Coppola. So after with all my sort of film knowledge of the Coppola, the extended family, when you sent me the list of potential films, I was like, ooh, Roman Coppola. I was like, but then I looked at the films, I was like, yep, let's go for that. So I wasn't actually overly aware. You know, I say I know Sofia Coppola, I know Talia Shire, I even know, is it Jack Schwartzman, who produced Never Say Never Again, because yep. I'm a big Bond fan as well. So I didn't even know about him. But yeah, Roman was a complete, I was like, oh, there's another one. And he's a director as well, or, you know, mainly an assistant director. But it was news to me.
Yeah, it's an interesting one with Roman, because the Coppola family own a winery. And there's a there's a Sophia wine, and there's a Gia Coppola wine, which is Roman and Sophia's niece. But then Roman doesn't have a wine. So it almost feels like even within the family, there's this kind of snub to him. And I always have this image of like Christmas dinners. And because he hasn't won an Oscar, he was nominated for one for co-writing Moonrise Kingdom, that like his dad's like, no, go sit at the kids' table, Roman. Like, you know, but it's crazy. Like,
you're no good to me, Roman.
Yeah. He's the Fredo Corleone of the Coppola family, I guess.
Oh, come on, guys, give me a break.
that's kind of in my fictionalized version of the Coppola family. That is very much who he is. But he's an interesting character because he's kind of got his fingers in this like what I'm calling like a surrogate cousin to the Coppola family, which is Wes Anderson. He's kind of like, he's there in the background of all of his films, whether it's like co-writing the Darjeeling Limited and even second unit stuff. He does it for like, he's done it for Jack. He did like second unit for a load of Sofia Coppola's films. So there's like this kind of, he's always there. And like,
yeah.
Yeah. So that's our connection for this one. So Well, you had no idea of Roman Coppola, so I guess you don't remember the first time you saw a film that he had his fingerprints on at all.
Well, looking into it, it does actually seem, and I'm a little bit ashamed to admit, it does seem like it is Jack. So, yeah, that is one of the random ones. I remember seeing that. I think I saw that at the cinema.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Probably when I was, because I was too young to watch any other sort of Coppola films. Like, oh, yeah, I'm going to see another Francis Ford Coppola film. It's about a guy that's really old, but he's actually a child.
Yeah, I recently read the reason he took on that script was because it chimed with him because he had polio as a child.
Okay.
And I was like, there are different ways to portray that in a film than doing a film about a kid who grows up too fast. It's like, no. And I think Coppola is a director who very much works best under pressure, as we see with kind of like...
Yeah.
Apocalypse Now, a film that's kind of like when he's got the studios and Hollywood like breathing down his neck, it's like, here's a fucking masterpiece. And it's like when he's fed and watered and rich, it's like, here's Jack.
Yeah. Deal with it. Here's a mediocre Grisham adaptation.
So what is your relationship to this film, and when did you first see it, George?
I remember having fond memories of seeing this when I was at uni in Manchester. I remember it was a sort of a favourite of me and my friends. I'm pretty sure we saw it at the cinema, but I definitely sort of revisited on DVD. But I just, yeah, have really fond memories. And I think I even went as far, like, this shows my age all the time. I remember downloading some of the soundtrack via LimeWire for,
amazing,
like... So yeah, listening to a bit of Su Jorge, is it the Brazilian guy? Fond memories, and I don't know. For me, like I knew of Wes Anderson. I'd seen his, I think I'd seen all his other films up there, because I think Rushmore like had such a claim when it came out, especially like in Empire magazine. I remember them talking about it. And I think I went back retroactively to watch Bottle Rocket. Royal Tenenbaums, I liked. But for this, yeah, for Life Aquatic, it's weird. I think it's a bit like, to use like a Bond sort of metaphor, it's a bit like Goldfinger. It's almost like when Wes Anderson got his formula right with all those different elements. I mean, yes, you've got the big all-star cast in Royal Tenenbaums, but this has that sort of mixture of everything, the Henry Selick animation, the really sort of whimsical, crazy sort of offbeat story, and a little bit, whereas I think obviously Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums are very New York sort of upper class type thing. So this felt different, but I think for a lot of people, it kind of was the first Wes Anderson film. It was kind of the Wes Anderson mainstream film in a way.
Yeah. And it's like, I think at the time was a big commercial and critical failure. So like,
yeah, I was surprised doing the research on it. I was really surprised when I read that. I was like, I remember it being, you know, another like, oh yeah, it's another Wes Anderson classic, but that obviously wasn't the case.
I think it's that thing that now, obviously in retrospect, we kind of look at it, and because it's got such a prescience and kind of it's out there in the cultural zeitgeist, and kind of like fancy dress parties, people will be dressing up, and it's kind of gained this like cult following almost.
People
kind of look back at it and go, it must have always been great. Whereas like at the time, yeah, for like a $50 million budget, it only made like 34.5, which is like,
yeah.
And I know
to ask these questions, was it quite a step up budget wise from Royal Tenenbaums? Because as I say, I imagine that's all on location in New York, that's going to be relatively cheap, whereas filming this all around Italy, isn't it?
It's around Italy and it's on real boats, so like
it's going to be pricey.
Yeah, and it's like Wes Anderson has since said there are aspects of this film that he would never do again. So it's like filming night shoots on a boat. He's like, well, now I would just do that on a soundstage. It's like, it's absolutely freezing. Like, but it kind of became attached to the Belafonte, in that like they had shipped it all the way from South Africa to the Mediterranean Sea so they could have it in Italy. And they kind of, I think it's that thing, but it's interesting for the film because it's almost like the filmmaking process is Wes Anderson is almost like Steve Zissou. It's like, I don't just want to make this film. I want to live this film. And I kind of like that when talking about like the Coppola family, because it feels like a Francis Ford Coppola move to do.
Well, it's ridiculous, the attention to detail. And, you know, there's not just it's not just the filming on the boat, as you say. It's the fact that they obviously have replicated the boat, you know, to do that, you know, cross section, which is amazing. And with the camera moving around. And I love all that stuff. I mean, it just adds to that Wes Anderson-ness. I mean, it's really weird to say, but even in the opening frame of just like the music and the font, mm-hmm. and you like, you know, it's a Wes Anderson film.
Yeah. And it's, doesn't it? So before we kind of get into what this film is about, do you mind kind of giving us a brief setup for the film, if you could?
Okay, so it's a bit of a tricky one because this film is a lot of things. So The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou is about an oceanographer. Mm-hmm. So a Jacques Cousteau, very much a Jacques Cousteau type guy who does ocean underwater documentaries, and it opens with his latest documentary where his best friend is killed by a mythical jaguar shark. And so he dedicates his next film to hunting the shark down as an act of revenge. But along the way, he meets possibly his illegitimate son, played by Owen Wilson. He encounters pirates, as well as hunting for the mythical jaguar shark. And there's his band of sort of misfits on his ship, the Belafonte. Is that good enough for you?
That's perfect. And there's kind of like, there's a lot of moving parts in this film, right? So I guess like, before we kind of get into it, a good place to start is talking about this mammoth cast that we have in this. It's kind of like, now it's like a who's who of Wes Anderson regulars and kind of some odd choices and it's also great choices in there as well.
Well, that's it. I think obviously, as I say, he kind of started it with Royal Tenenbaums. That was mm-hmm. quite a cast he'd collected on that. And it does seem like that, again, it's a Wes Anderson trait. It's like, how many crazy people can I get in one film? I haven't seen this film in probably maybe 4 or 5 years, and I've forgotten like all the people that crop up. So I forgot about Michael Gambon popping up mm-hmm. in it, and who else in there? And yeah, there's just so many great characters that pop up, and even if they have a tiny amount of screen time, they leave you wanting more in a way. You want to sort of know more, spend more time with them.
Yeah, and it's like, well, for me, a person who kind of steals the show in this film is Willem Dafoe, and he kind of. He kind
of, as Klaus.
Yeah, he says in interviews that he didn't really like, he would look at his call sheet and it would be like, I got 2 lines today. But then like, it's all the stuff he's, and because I guess it's the way that Wes Anderson works. And like you said earlier, this is the first film where he kind of really refined his style, in that like stuff's going on in the background all the time. And it's like, it's great for rewatchability because it's like, oh, they're kind of walking around the ship and it's like, what's Klaus doing? Or do you know what I mean? Vikram doing? They've kind of got all these like different characters doing their own little things. And yeah, Willem Dafoe is just like fantastic and has some of the best lines, I think.
Because I think it's the funniest that Willem Dafoe's been. I mean, it's, you know, shows his sort of his comedy chops. And yeah, he has, as you say, he has some of the funniest lines, like that interplay between him and Owen Wilson, where they're sort of trying to out-tough each other. And Klaus just keeps breaking.
I love the line that Klaus says when Ned threatens him, and he says like, next time you touch me, I'm gonna knock your teeth out. And he's like, not if I see you first, Sonny. And it's like, it kind of makes no sense, but it's just like, it's perfect in the way that it's like, it's threatening, but also absolute gobbledygook that you're coming out with right now.
Yeah, and there's the moment when Owen Wilson slaps him back and he's like, we're even now. He's like, but no, I need to hit you back. He's like, no, because then we wouldn't be even again. He's like, it's not fair.
So let's talk about the kind of opening of this film. What do you kind of make of this festival? Like, yeah, it's supposed to be like an Italian film festival setting in a world in which documentaries about jaguar sharks are kind of the prized film, the kind of opening film for a festival.
Yeah, and the equivalent of the Royal Albert Hall or something. It's a very grand, you know, surrounding. And it's a great sort of juxtaposition because, yeah, the documentary itself, and again, it just goes down to sort of, I don't know how you describe it, just the Wes Anderson weirdness or the kitschiness of the fact that it's all like clearly done on a studio and it's clearly like, you know, stop motion fish and stuff like that. And I don't know, it just adds to the charm, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's beautiful in the way that it sets everyone up as well, because obviously you kind of...
Yes, very much so.
And you get that impression that it's like all of like Steve Zissou's worlds are colliding at once, because you kind of like characters are brought in, whether it's like somebody we assume he's had a fling with in the past who he tries to like kiss on the cheek, that woman who's like,
that's really random. I remember that. I was just like, oh yeah, they don't go back to that. I mean, obviously they just keep playing that he's a bit of a sleaze.
Yeah, then you kind of get like Angelica Houston is, well, she gets that introduction when he kind of goes through the crew and stuff like that, but like she pops in, and then Jeff Goldblum's character Alistair and stuff like that, and you get a sense within the first 5 minutes of this like who Steve Zissou is, and like one of them is like he's charming but at the same time he is a bit of a prick, because like,
I've got that in my notes. It's like he's a bit of a dick, he's really egotistical, but I don't know if it's the Murray charm, it just makes him really engaging.
Yeah, because Wes Anderson said like his two influences for the character were Jacques Cousteau and Bill Murray himself. And there are the moment where the guy's asking him to sign all of those posters.
I love that moment.
Is from an actual moment with Bill Murray.
Really?
And on set, he said to Bill Murray, he's like, oh no, when you did that in real life, you did it like this. And he kind of had no recollection of it, but kind of watching some of like the behind the scenes footage, and there's like people coming up to Bill Murray, like at one point someone shoves a phone in his face. He's like, oh, can you speak to my friend? And like Bill Murray's just like, this is the police, we've got your friend here, you better get down here right now. And it's like the lines are very much blurred between Steve Zissou and Bill Murray, and it's like you just kind of, I don't know, I guess that plays to the film's strengths, but I can definitely see how that would turn some people off of the film in some way.
Yes, I mean, I think that's why I maybe like was drawn to Wes Anderson's film, because you know we grew up big fans of Bill Murray, you know, we Ghostbusters on regular repeat, you know, Groundhog Day, and yeah, you just love that sort of dry, deadpan delivery. And yeah, it was Rushmore that was like his, you know, renaissance, wasn't it? That he was kind of in Wilderness for a few years, and that kind of effectively gave him a new career and a bit, you know, it's. But I think is after this, like he kind of moves to being a supporting player in a lot of Wes Anderson stuff, hasn't he?
Yeah, so like the Darjeeling Limited, he kind of gets like a cameo at best, where he's like, the film starts with it looks like it's focused on Bill Murray running for the train, and then it's like he's overtaken by the brothers in the film, and then it's like it's not about him at all.
Yeah, and so he's kind of got like a blink and you miss it role in Grand Budapest, isn't he? He's like one of the other hotel managers.
Yeah, the Society of Crossed Keys.
Crossed Keys, yeah. But yeah, he's just like, he's brilliant in this. I say I am a bit biased because I do love Bill Murray. And as you say, this is almost like Bill Murray at his Bill Murrayest, you know, that sort of dry deadpan thing. And there's, yeah, so many brilliant deliveries, like, you know, when they ask him right at the start, what would be the scientific purpose of killing the shark? And he just sort of takes a beat and goes, well, revenge.
It's I love that there's another moment early on with the like the guy who the heckler who says like, who are you going to kill on your next adventure, Steve? And like as I said, like for a kind of setup for a film, it perfectly portrays him that he's got this like he's got this mean streak in him where he's like he's obviously hurt, but at the same time he has no way of processing that in a kind of like
controlled
manner in any way. It's kind of like he's and I think it's something that Wes Anderson does really well in that like. This is almost like a child's view of what an adult or what a celebrity is. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's almost like written by a child. It's like yeah, we're going out for revenge. And like if somebody like I don't know, like a teenage boy would be like, yeah, you just punch someone, stuff like that. And it's like
Well, that's it. And it's the great thing is that he doesn't even he attacks this guy and he doesn't even win. He comes away with like a bloody lip.
Yeah.
And so it's like, yeah, the fact that he is always sort of he's up for the fight, but he doesn't always win. But I'd be interested to, and I don't know if you know this, like how much of improvisation Wes Anderson allows, because you know how much you can tell, you know, Murray is a great improviser, but I imagine, you know, Wes Anderson is quite a control freak, and this is him and Noah Baumbach, isn't it?
Yeah.
Scripts. So whether there is that a little bit, because some of the lines feel very Murray-esque, but so, as you say, because it's written with him in mind, maybe.
So Bill Murray had said in regards to Rushmore around that time that like when he gets scripts, the way he looks at them is like, what writing essentially do I have to do on top of this film? Like, do you know what I mean? Like, what improvisations have I got to put in? Like, where can I elevate this script to? And he said when he got the script for Rushmore, he went, this is written perfectly. I'm going to do what's on the page. I guess there's obviously leeway for like takes where it's like, do you know what I mean? Like, you go
play around with
off.
It.
Yeah. But like, I think the way that, well, even more so with Wes Anderson's films later on, it is that thing that everything is like a tight like stopwatch, and it's all really like intricately done where it's like the lines almost have to be delivered in a certain rhythm. And well, yeah, watching a behind the scenes documentary, like when he's trying to get like when he's just shouting Esteban at the beginning in that video, they've got Bill Murray in a tank. And Wes Anderson is there, like, saying to him, like, so I want one long Esteban, and then on the second two, I want it kind of like one after the other, really quick. So, like, there is this thing of, like, you get a bit of Bill. And as you said, the film was written with Bill Murray
in mind.
So I guess it's that thing, like, I don't know. We'll never know. I know. I think the script for this one is out there, so I would like to kind of see if there's a way to like
compare the two.
Yeah, I imagine there probably is some Bill Murrayisms in there, and but I think I don't know because it's a difficult character to kind of, and it's weird. And obviously, like we've mentioned Rushmore quite a lot, but I think they like thematically. Like work really well together because and their lead characters in both of them are the best part, like not likable. Like you are essentially like in kind of like, and yeah, like if they were a character populated in another film, they would be like a villain almost. They would be an antagonist. Cause like you got this guy who's he's on a thing of vengeance, which is like quite immoral in the fact that it's like going after an endangered species. He's happy to steal from like a really nice guy who just happened to like for what we get from the film, it's Jeff Goldblum's character was married to Eleanor before Steve was. So it's like that thing of like you're almost like the dick in this situation where you're like the kind of I don't know, you assume that he probably wooed Eleanor away from Alistair. So it's like
And he's also it's quite clear that he's uses a lot of Eleanor's parents' money. You know, that's a sort of recurring theme throughout the film. And I think like with it's interesting with it's been a while since I've seen Rushmore as well, but it feels like his character in Rushmore and his character in this, there's that similarity of, it's almost like he's going through, well, it's not, is it a midlife crisis? It might be a bit beyond that, but in terms of, yes, he's a dick, yes, he's flawed, but he's almost like trying to make up for his mistakes by reconnecting with Ned. And yeah, he's, you know, he does seem to learn a bit by the end of the film.
Yeah, but we get that weird thing with the relationship between Ned and Steve, where it's like, it's kind of up in the air for most of it, whether like, does he care if he's his son or not, or is he just using him for the money?
Yeah.
It's like, and you kind of like, it kind of runs parallel with the character of Max Fisher, like the kind of everyone in his life he kind of uses as a pawn in his game, whether it's like his chapel partner, where it's like, do his bidding and stuff like that, and it's like he's just got his end goal, and it's like, and I think, yeah, like it makes for a really interesting, I like the fact that there's that thematic kind of lineage through Wes Anderson's career, and even down to the fact that I think Max Fisher becomes infatuated by the teacher because he finds a Jacques Cousteau book in the library, and then there's like, yeah, these weird like things that kind of connect the films, in that all of the photos of Mrs. Cross's ex-husband who died, he died by drowning, but all the photos of him in her room are photos of Owen Wilson, because obviously he wrote the film. And then obviously Owen Wilson drowns
in this
film. Yeah. So it's like that thing of like, it's almost like they're in this kind of weird shared universe, or from what I know, Wes Anderson had this story in his pocket for 15 years. He said he kind of had this idea of an oceanographer for all that time.
That's nuts. Because I was thinking, is Owen Wilson in every single Wes Anderson film in some form?
I think so. I think he is like his, they're friends, right? And it's like, because
obviously they're in, it's both Wilson brothers in Bottle Rocket, isn't it? Thinking that obviously we'll get to it later in sort of the connections. I was thinking, well, Owen Wilson's in every single one of his films, so there's some sort of connection there. I mean, the larger cast in this is great. I mean, Angelica Houston is great, just, you know, as, you know, they're constantly referred to as the brains of the operation, and just sort of just sitting there, sort of, she's above it all, she's smoking away. We've talked about, you know, Willem Dafoe. I love all the smaller characters that aren't, you know, don't get much to do, but they're still just all like, you know, working away and doing their stuff.
So Matthew Gray Gubler, who I think now people know him from Criminal Minds, he kind of plays like the quote unquote, like every kind of show has it, where it's like, are they autistic and they seem to figure out all the crimes all the time. Like that's just
right.
Kind of
okay.
Like niche on that show, like their weird angle for it. He plays like the kind of curly haired intern who gets the machete through his shoulder, who was Wes Anderson's actual intern at the time.
That's amazing.
And let him, like, so there's, I think you can kind of see it throughout the film. He got him to do the making of documentary for the film. Like, so.
Because I think I read, isn't the sound guy in the film, is he Wes Anderson's sound guy as well? Like the guy who's recording all the sounds?
Yeah, so a lot of the people, so are kind of cohorts or named after. So there's a guy who Wes Anderson worked with all the time called Wally Wolodowski, and obviously in this we get Noah Taylor's character as Vladimir Wolodowski, and it's like these like nice little kind of links to people he knows and stuff like that. And him and Noah Baumbach tell a story of, you know, when Steve and Ned go to the Explorers Club and there's those like young guys taking the piss out of Steve.
Yes.
That's based on like a story of one of their friends who had like saw somebody who looked like an aging action star told this story going like, oh yeah, look, so-and-so did this, did that and the other, and then at the end of it realized, oh shit,
it was,
that is Bruce Willis. I like, do you know what I mean?
Brilliant. No, I completely forgotten about that scene, and it's, again, it's establishing their sort of relationship. But yeah, you kind of forget, like, it's a little bit cringeworthy when it's like, yeah, he's saying, oh yeah, apparently he hit on my mate's 15-year-old niece, and you're like, ooh. But then you can kind of believe it with Zissou. He just has a go at anyone.
Yeah, and it's this weird thing as well. Like, I totally forgot, like, how kind of homophobic Steve comes across, like, in this, because obviously, like, the first...
Yeah, because obviously there's the whole thing with Jeff Goldblum, isn't it?
Yeah, and, like, I should probably address this. Like, how does that kind of, like, because there's obviously, like, this ongoing joke, quote-unquote, where he's, like, keeps calling him a faggot. Or like, yeah, saying like he's a queer and stuff like that. And then obviously the payoff to that joke is at the end, Jeff Goldblum's character says like,
oh, he admits, doesn't he?
Well, I am, yep, half gay. And it's like,
yeah,
did like, it feels like a joke that would be in like a teen sex comedy from like the early 2000s, not this.
Yeah, it does feel a little bit of a cop-out that they could have just had, you know, Jeff Goldblum being a little bit effeminate, and that's, you know, that's Steve's flaw, that the fact that he's always belittling him for being, you know, camp. But yeah, I thought that, like, it's, I don't know, it kind of works in Goldblum's delivery. You kind of, you kind of get away with it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is it's one of the sort of more troublesome stuffs, problematic, I should say.
Yeah, and I guess another thing, like, I've heard people mention before is obviously, like, the lack of female characters in this film, and kind of, like, when they are there, they don't really get to do much. So, like, the character of Anne-Marie Sakovitz, who, when we meet her, has got her boobs out, and or is kind of, like, just seen, like, kind of a stick in the mud at, like, she's the one who's like, you guys are going through uncharted waters and stuff like that, and it's, yeah, kind of like, come on guys, like, that there's a whole crew of people here, why do you have to paint the woman to be like the one who's like, mm.
But then it depends on how you argue, because you argue that all the blokes are idiots for blindly following yes, Zissou, and they, I say, they do make it quite clear that Eleanor's the brains of the operation, and mm-hmm, she comes through and saves him multiple times.
I think, like, Angelica Houston, amazingly, like, kind of, she just has this, like, gravitas in any film that she's in. I guess, for me, like, there's this weird thing that for years I had to shake off the image of the Grand High Witch from The Witches, and it's, like
or Morticia Adams as well.
Yeah, yeah, but, like, yeah. I just have this, like, uncontrollable fear as a young kid of, like, the Grand High Witch. So it's, like, when I see her now, I can kind of put that to one side and be like, she is just like, she has such like grace in this film as well, and yeah, it's like when she's on screen, which is like not that much, but she gets to deliver like some of, like, I think, I don't know, at least one of the most important lines in this film, when Steve tells her that they're going out on this expedition, and she says, well, one of you's dead already, and you kind of like, because it's a bit grey, that line, because it's just after Ned has kind of
joined.
And he's drowned. Yeah. He's kind of, because she asked, like, did his heart stop beating?
Oh, yes. Yeah, that part where he's in the training montage, effectively. Yeah.
And it's like, and then it kind of ties in once Ned does die, that the camera pans down to the viewing platform. And it's just kind of like lingers on a shot of Angelica Houston. And it's kind of like that line almost plays like a, I don't know, like the Chekhov's gun of this film. It's like,
yeah, it's almost like prophetic. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, it's like that whole scene is like, well, we're showing you he can't really swim, so it's going to come up in the third act, everybody.
And she obviously has the, and again, I kind of like had half forgotten, but she has the killer twist that, you know, Ned is probably not Sisu Sidon because he shoots blanks. And I love that sort of, you know, sort of, don't ask me how I know, I'm a scientist.
Yeah, and she also delivers that line to Cate Blanchett. And what do you make of Cate Blanchett's performance in this film?
It's an odd one. I kind of like it, but it's sort of like, again, it's very random. It's, you know, she has her own subplot going on about her being pregnant and it being the editor's, you know, baby, and he's married and stuff like that. And she, you know, obviously she's part of the love triangle, effectively, if it is a triangle between Steve and Ned. So, yeah, it's a weird role, but it's obviously she's gets Steve, Steve to react to certain stuff, and, you know, is peeling away the layers with him. But yeah, I don't know if she's a likable person or whether she could be seen as annoying, but she's interesting, definitely.
Yeah, I find her like fascinating in the fact that, like, and I think it's that thing of like, I don't know, is it one piece too many in this kind of weird puzzle? Because it's like, I guess you get that mirroring of the whole thing of like, because she delivers a line about looking for like a father for her baby. I think she like, she's in shock and delivers, she's like, I'm looking for a baby for this father. And like Steve's like, I know exactly what you mean. Like, because it's after the pirate attack or whatever. And you kind of get that mirroring of that thing of like, so you have that Ned looking for his dad, and then you kind of get this thing of her then looking for like some kind of family,
yeah,
whatever it is. And I think that's like at the core of this film is what it's about, right? It's that thing of like trying to find family, and like family doesn't have to be like blood. Relatives,
yeah.
And it's kind of what we see with the kind of Zizou gang is that they are kind of like this ramshackled, I don't know, misfits of people who kind of don't fit in anywhere else. And it's like, we got a bus driver, we got like a, I don't know, like a supply teacher or whatever, and they're kind of like all coming onto this boat to be a part of this family.
Because then he even says that to Klaus. He says, Esteban and I always thought of you as our little brother sort of type thing.
Which Klaus says, what is it he says there? In response to that, I always saw you as two dads. And he's like, yeah, please don't tell anyone if that sounds a bit weird. is there any particular scenes that you really feel like we should kind of chew over and really get into?
Just having a think. I mean, I'll say that, yeah, there's so much, like, it goes off in so many little strands. I say you've got the random bit with pirates. You've got the sort of adventure part with, you know, hunting the jaguar shark. And it's, yeah, I don't know. I like the fact that the Henry Selick animation, then obviously he would go on to do Fantastic Mr. Fox and I Love Dogs. I still haven't seen that, by the way. I love it. It just adds to that sort of surrealness of the whole piece. In terms of we haven't touched on the soundtrack. I mean, it's a phenomenal soundtrack.
So yeah, both the, like, I guess it's what we get with Wes Anderson films, right? You get like kind of a two for one where it's like you get needle drops and then you get these, especially in this earlier stage of his career, you get the Mark Mothersbaugh, like from Devo, his kind of like,
yes, I love all that like electro synthy stuff. It's brilliant,
it's perfect, and you kind of like, and it fits perfectly in this world, because obviously Noah Taylor's character is, when you're introduced to everyone, he is like the guy writing the music. So it's like, yeah, it all sounds like it's made on like little drum machines and Casio keyboards and stuff like that. And it's I love the kind of Zizou Society like theme, like that kind of like plinky plonky piano. It's like,
yes,
yeah, that, and then it kind of like gets almost like a remix at the end when they go down on the submarine. He's like, oh, here's Ned's theme, and it's kind of like that with like a thumping bass drum and stuff like that.
And obviously, you've got as I mentioned early on, you've got Brazilian singer Sue George doing all the Bowie covers, which is amazing. And again, yeah, I say, like, we listened to that loads when it first came out, and it just adds, again, yeah, it's just such a uniqueness to the film. It's great. And I love the bits in the, like, as you say, you know, you talked about logistics of filming on a real boat, but it makes the films, like, I love those sweeping shots of that boat party at the start where it's constantly following back, again, sort of soundtracked by Bowie. But, you know, it's following to the front of the boat. I don't know my boat terms. Is it the prow? and then back again. And it's focusing on all the different, you know, conversations and stuff. I think that's... and then again, you've got, I say, the cross-section of the boat as well. I love all that stuff. And I love that throwaway line of, you've got, you know, a spa inside. You've got a lab, a recording thing. But then he talks about the kitchen, which has the most advanced equipment on the ship. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if the... Is the pirate subplot one subplot too many? It just feels a little bit left field, but it is still, you know, it's enjoyable, you know, how it does with that whole set piece with the rundown hotel and stuff.
So I love that. Like, when that stuff happens, as much as it is like a kind of, like, you could, if you were strict with this film, you could go in with scissors and go, like, let's get that out of there. But I think it kind of adds, like, I don't know, and it makes the film feel like you are almost watching one of Steve Zissou's,
like, it's like a fever dream, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like it's one of Steve Zissou. It's like you're watching the film within the film almost, and it's like, or like hearing one of Steve's stories of what happened, and it's like, maybe if you saw the real thing, like, it wasn't like that at all, or whatever. And
it's
and you get some of the best comedy out of that as well.
Yeah, well, definitely. And as you say, it's all, you know, it's set up at the start, you know, literally Chekhov's gun, the fact that he has that rule, everyone carries a piece, you know, everyone has a gun. And it's just sort of like, but why do they need that? And then obviously it's, you know, becomes apparent. And yeah, I love that. It does just add to the surrealness and the absurdity of the fact that it does, you know, for 5-10 minutes turns into a bit of an action film with them storming this, you know, derelict hotel.
Well, I think as well, it kind of, like, it gets an audience, it's clever in the way that it gets an audience, like, it really builds you up, like, it gets your heart racing, as it were. And then, like, it literally comes crashing down when we, like, see Steve at his lowest. But at the same time, he's always on in a way, because he says, like, when he falls down the stairs, he's like, did you get that? Like, did you see that? And he's like, this is what the film is. And it's like, this film feels like it is a meditation on filmmaking, and very specifically, like, Wes Anderson's way of, like, making a film. Like, even, like, right up, like, that thing with film festivals, like, opening and closing the film at a film festival, and, like, that thing of, you have this mission to seek this pure, like, mythic creature, which almost could be like a film, where you're like, I'm trying to get this unattainable thing, but at some point you've just got to let it go. And kind of like the way they're looking through the, like, viewfinder in the submarine is kind of framed like it's a TV screen, essentially, and
they're
kind of all looking at it swim away, and it's like kind of him saying, like, let's just wash our hands, let's just, like, the film is done.
And yeah, there's that, you know, that bit at the end with the jaguar shark again, like, sort of just brings me back to my uni days of listening to Sigur Rós on repeat, and just, oh, it's beautiful music, I have no idea what they're saying, but it's so beautiful. But it is a really touching moment, even though, yeah, I say it is absurd. You've got, you know, how many people in that two-man sub, and it even has a little sign saying no more than two people in. And you've got, the Henry Selick's stop motion animation, but it's a beautiful scene. It's really nice. And it's really, I don't know why it's touching, but it is, you know, even though it's so ridiculous, it still manages to come across as touching. And I suppose that's just the power of filmmaking in terms of the editing, the music and everything.
I think the thing that works really well with this film as well is the fact that you kind of get blindsided, where you've been following a character throughout it, where you go, like, oh, he's a bit of a dick, and then by the end of it you're like, I actually really care what happens to him. And like by the time kind of credits roll, we get that like amazing like thing of like everyone joining him as he's like,
I love that,
walking down the walking down the pier, and you've got even Werner, who's in his kind of Steve Zissou-esque lederhosen now, and like everyone's joining. Like, everyone's like, and it's like, I fucking like, I want to be a part of that team. And it's like, yeah, it's fantastic.
Well, I was thinking that in terms of the the Steam Suzu uniform, obviously they talk about the he has his own Adidas. And did they actually release Suzu limited edition Adidas three stripes? You know, the
I remember
those retro trainers.
I looked a while ago, and there might have been like a very small run at the time, but they've kind of, you can get like, people have customized, I guess it's like Sambas. I think you can kind of, or like there's a certain style that you can, you can like essentially get an all white pair.
Is
and
it
then,
called Gazelles?
Are gazelles, they Gazelles. Yeah, they are. They are essentially gazette like.
I
don't know why they haven't done it as like, I don't know, a ten, like in 2014, the 10-year anniversary, or I don't. But part of me thinks like maybe it's a Wes Anderson thing where he's like, I like it for the film, but then if I like do it as like a corporate tie-in outside of the film,
I don't want to be a sellout.
Yeah, then it's gross. Do you know what I mean? Like in the same way he didn't really want to cast the kid from Dennis the Menace in Rushmore as his chapel partner, because it's like he's been in something really successful. It's like you've also got Bill Murray, who was in the is in Ghostbusters 2. So like you can't pick and choose when you want to like only deal with cool people. So I'm just trying to think of like any other areas that we have missed out on. I guess I don't how does it make you feel about like the death of Ned in this? How do you think it's handled within the film?
That's a good point, because that's one of my issues with Wes Anderson, in all honesty, that I remember people raving about how much they loved Grand Budapest. And it is one of those films that has grown on me, but I didn't like it as much first time around, because a lot of his films have this melancholy, this sort of bittersweet ending that always ends in a sort of a death at, is it always like necessary? So, you know, for example, in Grand Budapest, you have obviously what happens to Gustav, but then it's, I can't remember what's the lead character in it called again? The bellboy?
Zero.
Zero's wife, you know, they get together, but then she dies. You know, it's all as part of like the epilogue sort of type thing. And that kind of like depressed me slightly. And I suppose it's less so in this, and it kind of all ties into the storytelling, but it always seems like it's a recurring theme in a lot of his films. There has to be, there's a little bit of, an element of tragedy towards the end.
It's like they can't get away from, especially him and Noah Baumbach together, they can't get away from this kind of navel-gazy New York thing where it's like, it can be funny, but it's got to have a bit of like pathos and sadness at the end. It's
It can't be Tuesday. It can't be all zany.
It's I think the thing that really elevates that is the choice of song for his funeral, that Zombies track, is absolutely like it floors me every time. And even like the build up to it, where it's got Scott Walker's 30th Century Man as they're kind of getting ready to go up in the helicopter and stuff like that. And it's like, I hadn't watched this for years until like I kind of watched it again recently and then rewatched it again today for the podcast. It's like, I'd kind of forgotten about the fact that like Ned dies, and it's, I don't know, like watching it again recently, and that like, that's that whole scene where you get that letter, and it's like, it's almost like Steve saying like, well, it doesn't matter either way if you're my son, like,
I still want you to be part of my life.
I think there is a case and to be.
I was going to say, and the fact is that his death, it just seems a little bit over the top, that the fact that they've crashed, and then he's kind of like, he's bleeding mysteriously from something. They don't really establish, like, the helicopter goes straight down and it's kind of like, oh yeah, and I'm bleeding to death and I'm dead. And it's sort of like, did he, and I keep saying, like, did he have to die? But yeah, I suppose it's all part of that bittersweet tale.
Well, the thing is, because it kind of has that, like, bizarre, like, well, I think it's, like, done really well, but those, like, interesting shots and cuts where it goes from, like, a flash of red, a flash of white, like the bubbles under the ocean.
Yes.
And Ned asking
reminded me, even though I haven't seen very little, but it felt very sort of 60s, you know, cinema a little bit, you know, is it maybe it's Truffaut or something like that, like where this, yeah, as you say, like jump cuts, random sort of inserts. And it's a bit disorientating, but I did like it. Yeah, it's a good, cool bit of style.
I thought if they'd kind of left it as that, and that kind of like, that let us know that he had died, like, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think the audience is smart enough to realise with that, like, and then, yeah, it's kind of a damp fish, like, when they kind of have that, like, because it's a bit of a nothing conversation afterwards.
But yeah.
I guess it's the thing of, like, they need that shot because they need the funeral, right? So there kind of needs to be the body. It can't just be like he never resurfaces from the water. I don't know. Like,
yeah, and I suppose it is just that, like, we need to make this absolutely clear. He's dead and it is him.
Amazing. Well, let's get on to some Coppola connections in regards to this film. Could you find any other links between this film and any other Coppola films with either people who have worked on it or in it?
So I've made a list. So because I listened to one of your previous episodes and there was a lot of connections. Like, oh God, I'm going to have to do my homework here. but obviously the biggest connection in this is Murray himself. So he's done at least two films with Sofia Coppola. He's done two big films. So he did, obviously, this Lost in Translation and...
On the
is
Rocks.
That most recent one he did, On the Rocks. I haven't seen that yet, have you?
No, that's that is obviously on the list for me, but there's so many films I have to kind of get around before I get to that one.
But it was also one of those, because it's exclusive to Apple TV, and you're like, oh, really? Can you not make it accessible
anywhere
else?
Another free trial? Like, oh,
really?
And it's only a seven-day free trial as well. They get you with that one.
But actually, I just remember my wife does have an Apple TV thing, so I might have to check that out. So yeah, you've obviously got Murray and Sofia Coppola. Obviously, you had Wes Anderson and Jason Schwartzman. Jason Schwartzman's not in this. He's like probably the one Anderson film he's not in. He seems like he's in nearly every other one. Is he? I don't know if he's in Moonrise Kingdom, but
yeah, he plays Cousin Ben in Moonrise Kingdom.
Right, okay.
He's not in the Royal Tenenbaums, which, like, it's really interesting. I found out recently that the character of Mordecai, the Falcon, was supposed to be another character, but, like, he realised there's too many moving parts and cut the character out. So that was going to be Jason Schwartzman's character, was an actual, I don't know, a person that Richie would have met as opposed to chatting to a Falcon.
Bizarre. a bit of a tenuous connection, but Michael Gambon was in Layer Cake, which is a Matthew Vaughn film. And then Matthew Vaughn did Kick-Ass with Mr. Nicolas Cage.
Perfect.
Also, Willem Dafoe was in the Spider-Man films and Mr. Cage was in Into the Spider-Verse as Spider-Man Noir.
I love it.
I've got just Jeff Goldblum ? And Angelica Houston ? I feel like they've been in so many films that there's bound to be. So I'm waiting for you to school me on this.
So
there's
bound to be
some connections.
Jeff Goldblum, weirdly, there is no connections, which I kind of
really
found, like, baffling. Apart from, like, the obvious actually, there is two connections that aren't Wes Anderson films, which is Jurassic World Fallen Kingdom and Jurassic World Dominion, which are both lensed by John Schwartzman, like the cinematographer. Angelica Houston is in Francis Ford Coppola's Gardens of Stone. She's in The Darjeeling Limited, which obviously stars Jason Schwartzman. Yeah. Isle of Dogs, she's in as well. And she's in a Michael Jackson-like film that Francis Ford Coppola did in the 80s called Captain EO.
Never heard of it.
Yeah, it's I hadn't until I kind of like did the research for this podcast. It's like I'm not sure if I have to watch that one because it's like an extended music video, I think. I don't think it's a feature film. And it's like, I don't really want to be talking about Michael Jackson either.
I mean, I am a completist, but I've got to draw the line somewhere.
Exactly. There's some Willem Dafoe connections with regards to Nicolas Cage. So he was in Dog Eat Dog with Nicolas Cage and Wild at Heart. And then there's a Mark Mothersbaugh connection to Nicolas Cage in that he scored the new Croods movie, Croods A New Age. So yeah, there's that one. And Michael Gambon is also in the terrible Christmas Carol, the movie, which is a 2001 Simon Gallo like starring adaptation of a Christmas Carol. I was going
to say, because there's one with Patrick Stewart that's supposed to be terrible as well. I was thinking it might be that one, but
no,
it seems like it's one that's like, oh, let's just churn out another one. We'll get some Brit in it and we'll put it on TV. It'll be fine.
Well, it's got Nicolas Cage as Marley's ghost. And it's like...
I'm sold.
But for how bombastic Nicolas Cage normally is in films, he sounds like somebody going, oh, I'm a ghost. It's like, really? It's like a couple of years earlier, this guy was cast a fucking Troy, and now like,
and you can tell they cast him for that reason. Like, he's going to be fucking off the wall. He's going to be bringing his own chains and everything. He is going to be brilliant. And then he's like, "Oh, guys, I'm just going to play it really low." Like, no, Nick, no, go crazy. We want crazy.
Yeah. So obviously, like, yeah, and it's animated as well, and it's so Kate Winslet is in it. And there was a song that Kate, like the only song that Kate Winslet has ever sung was for that film. So if you remember, without looking too, I'm not going to bother Googling it because it'd probably take me a while to find it. But yeah, it's a very bizarre animated film that you should not watch at Christmas ever. Apart from that, there's, yeah, all of the other kind of Coppola connections are very obvious in regards to the Wes Anderson connection. And a Sophia one that you missed is she directed A Very Murray Christmas, the Netflix special.
I didn't realize she was behind that. I knew of A Murray Christmas, and it wasn't until I was going through the notes I saw that I haven't seen it, which is bizarre because I say I'm a big fan of Murray, but it just seemed a bit weird. I'm just like, is it going to be any good, or is it going to be cringe?
Yeah, it's. I think it falls somewhere in between those two things. Like,
I'm always a bit dubious of these. Yeah, Christmas specials. It's like, oh, really?
And Roman Coppola again was second unit director on A Very Murray Christmas. And
well, there you go.
Just a weird thing that I will have to cover at some point is he directed the Mariah Carey Christmas special that came out on Apple TV last year.
I think my wife did watch that.
So that is directed by Roman Coppola. So, like,
I was going to say, so that was going to be my question. Has he, what's the biggest thing that he's directed solely, like, has sole credit for?
So he has directed 3 films. I'm trying to think off the top of my head. So I know 2 of them are, he did a film called CQ from the year 2000, and has directed a film called Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III. Which stars Bill Murray and has like a kind of I think Charlie Sheen's in it, Patricia Arquette, and there's like a lot of like kind of Wes Anderson alumni in that film as well. So I think Jason Schwartzman pops up. So
okay,
the fact that like not many people have heard of it, I am trepidatious to whether it is any good. But I guess. Yeah, listen to a future episode where I delve into that one.
Well, yes, it's a bit of a funny one with, like, again, it's something that you sort of delve into in terms of, like, film knowledge, in terms of, you know, first director, second unit and stuff like that. That I, like, it's something that I was reading recently. Have you heard of the stuntman Vic Armstrong? He did, like, he was Indiana Jones and Superman and did a lot of the Bond films, but he became in his late career like a very accomplished second unit director. And I think he only directed one film, but it seems like once you get in that sort of not pigeonhole, but you kind of, you're quite happy with that. Like, yep, I'll just carry on doing second unit. And it seems it's a bit of an anomaly in my mind. Like, well, surely you want to keep going until you get into that, you know, overall director.
Well, Roman Coppola is very interesting in the fact that, like, he's kind of got a lot of like strings to his bow in that, like, he's a producer on a lot of stuff. He now runs American Zoetrope, the
studio
that, yeah, Francis Ford Coppola started, and has like got TV projects. I'm not sure if you ever saw the Amazon Prime original Mozart in the Jungle.
I heard of it. Was that with Gael Garcia Bernal?
Yes. So that is created by Jason Schwartzman, Roman Coppola, Paul Weitz, and Alex Timbers. So, and like, he's got like directing credits for a load of the episodes on that show. So it's like that thing of like, he's like the shadowy figure in the back of the Coppola family. Like, I don't know. I guess if he were in the submarine at the end, he would very much be like Jeff Goldblum's character, like poking his head up at the back. Yeah. Yeah. Or the Bond company stooge.
I love him. And I forgot about that killer line when Jeff Goldblum's like, is this my coffee machine? And he's like, where did it come from? And he's just like, we fucking stole it, man.
He's amazing. Bud Cort. And he's another one where I find it bizarre where Wes Anderson has said, like, we wrote that role specifically for him. And it's that thing of like, I don't know. I guess what Anderson would have had the cachet at this time for people to say to people like, can you come in to do like these small roles? Because like,
yeah, I've written it. Well, I suppose it's a good way to win the moment. I've written it specially for you.
Yeah. Like Sir George, like he doesn't really, well, he got a whole like David Bowie, like.
Got an album out of it.
He got an album out of it. And like, as much as he doesn't say anything, he does loads. And yeah, he kind of like, he's great when he's on screen. And then he gets these moments where it's like, like that brilliant one where he's singing, the Bowie track on the back of the boat, and it's as the pirates turn up and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's completely oblivious.
Yeah, he's like singing Starman, I think it is at that point. So let's get on to rating this film. And the way I do that on this podcast is asking you, what would be the perfect wine pairing for this film?
Well, I think because it's set in and around Italy, I'm thinking something red, something Italian, something maybe, you know, I like a lot of Italian reds, so maybe something, you know, like a Nero d'Avolio, something like that, or, you know, something fruity. I think it'd have to be an Italian red, something punchy like that.
Perfect. I'm going to go off-piste with this one and say this is the perfect film to drink a Campari on the rocks with.
Well, I am currently drinking a Campari and tonic in honor of Mr. Zissou. So that's probably the little, you know, you can hear the tinkling of ice in my Campari.
Perfect. So how much are we paying for this bottle of wine? Are we sticking on the first page of the menu, or are we flipping over to the other side?
I think in sort of, well, it, you know, there obviously is that throwaway line in the film about like when the guy goes to serve wine to Owen Wilson, he's like, no, serve it to me, that he knows nothing about wine. So I think it has to be a good wine. I think it has to be at least page two, because you don't want to be seen as being a bit of a skinflint or not knowing about wine. So go for the middle page and you're in sort of safe territory.
I like at that point as well that like he wouldn't have been able to afford that bottle of wine. That like,
yes.
Do you know what I mean? He's probably like, yeah, just put it on like Michael Gambon's character's account or whatever. Like, or I've got some credit here. Like, people know me. Like, so would you recommend people check out this film if they haven't already?
It's a funny one on this one, because I think Wes Anderson is an acquired taste. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of people that don't get him or just don't like him. It's I can understand why some people might see it as a little bit pretentious, a little bit too whimsical. Mm-hmm. It's an acquired taste of comedy. It's quite dry. It's quite surreal. It's not like your clear gags and setup. But I love it. I think it's probably my favorite Wes Anderson film. I think it's got a great lead, one of Bill Murray's best performances. I just love how random it is, how surreal and quirky. But so I would definitely, if you're a fan of Wes Anderson's films and you haven't seen this, which I imagine is a bit of a stretch, or a fan of Bill Murray and haven't seen this, I would definitely recommend it. I would also recommend it to any Bowie fans.
Yes,
I think that's a must. So yeah, it is definitely a tricky one with Wes Anderson, because I realize, it's a bit like, in a way, Napoleon Dynamite. I love that film, but I realize that it's just a bit weird for some people's sense of humor, that they just don't get it.
That's a perfect comparison to make for these two films. And like, I don't know, because there's an element of me where it's like, I love this film. Like, I'm just like, and I think it's the first Wes Anderson I may have seen. And I had this like, I don't know, and I found it with a lot of, like, so I've been revisiting a lot of the Wes Anderson films recently. They kind of hit you differently at what stage of life you watch them. So like, with something like this, it's like when I was younger, I was like kind of swept away in the swashbuckling of it all, and kind of like being like, yeah, that would be great, and like kind of like almost relating to Steve, do you know what I mean, that kind of thing. And I think it's like at the end of the film where like he reads the article that she's written about him, the journalist, and says like, oh, people are going to think I'm a bit of a blowhard, a bit of a blowhard and a bit of a prick. And it's like that thing of like, as you get older, you realize like, oh yeah, like you start to realize, not necessarily those things, but you kind of get a bit more self-awareness. And it's like,
yes,
this film happens to be about a man in his 50s getting some self-awareness. But I think like I'm a lot more self-aware than I was when I first saw this film as like a teenager, going like, that's really cool.
Well, yeah, I to echo your point you had earlier, like there's so much going on in these films that they do stand up to repeat mm-hmm. watches. And I think, yeah, they do benefit from, like I say, I wasn't the biggest fan of Grand Budapest when I first saw it, but the more I watch it, the more I enjoy it and the more I get out of it. But yeah, as I say, his style is an acquired taste, but at the same time, it's amazing how he has created his own style, and as I say, how instantly recognizable his style is.
Yeah, and I think, like you mentioned, this is like the first film that really kind of like, we're in Wes Anderson land now, do you know what I mean? Like, whereas the Royal Tenenbaums, like, it's kind of got a foot in both worlds, where it's like, it's New York, but it's Wes Anderson's New York, whereas this is mm-hmm. like
proper sort of crazy town.
yeah you're in crazy, yeah, because it's like, it's not, I don't know, even though it's Italy, it's like that it doesn't fit, it feels like this fairy tale, like a picture book version of what Italy is, as opposed to like a real place. So let me ask you, which is proving to be one of the most difficult questions on the podcast, which Coppola family member would you keep? But in doing so, you have to get rid of the filmography of everyone else in the family.
This is a really tough one. and I am just going to go for the cop-out answer and just say, Godfather and Godfather 2 are, two masterpieces. I do need to revisit the conversation. It's been a while since I've seen that, but I remember that being very good. So yeah, I don't know. But then again, Lost in Translation is one of my favorite films. I think that's a great film. But then I'm not overly bowled over by Sofia Coppola's other films. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I am just going to cop out and say, yeah, you've got to keep The Godfather and Godfather Part Two, and obviously the other stuff that he's done.
that is like, I think that is the surefire front runner at the moment. And it's interesting to hear people's interpretation of it. Some people are like ultimately selfish with their answers, where it's like, well, I love this film, so I'm keeping that person. Whereas other people are like, the greater good of cinema would be at its best if Francis Ford Coppola, for instance, were kept. Because it's like, there's the whole...
It's amazing how far, the whole point of, you doing this podcast, like how far the Coppola connections how deep it runs, because yeah, it was I was listening to your conversation episode with Rich from Betamax, and he mentioned about, but that means I'd have to get rid of Rocky IV, and I'm just like, oh god, yeah. It's just all these like connections of like, but that's such a beloved film, but then you're like, on the other hand, you're like, but it's Godfather yeah. 1 and 2.
Yeah, and it's that whole like, you get rid of Francis Ford Coppola, then you think of like the ramifications on cinema, and it's like,
yeah,
but a lot of people are like, you then lose Star Wars, or you then lose, yeah, and if you lose Star Wars, you lose Star Trek, and it's like, it's the films wouldn't have been made without the kind of success of Star Wars, to be like,
yeah, because he was Lucas's sort of mentor in a way, wasn't he?
Yeah, so Lucas won a competition through his university to be on set at Warner Brothers, and it happened to be that Francis Ford Coppola was filming Finian's Rainbow and saw him across the kind of lot, and he was like the only person on the lot, because it was kind of like handing over of the baton between old and new Hollywood, and it's like,
yes.
Everyone on the set was like 50 plus, and then there's these two young guys with beards
and like, two bearded nerds,
and they kind of went bang, like, let's, and then
do you want to hang out?
Yeah, and then it's like, like, even if you look back as like American Graffiti, like, that's produced by Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah,
THX
1138. Yeah,
is released like through American Zoetrope, and it's like, yeah, like, I think, I don't know what people think of George Lucas and that. It's like, that is something that has come up time and time again on this podcast. It's like, that is a kind of like,
no, it's a good point saying, you know, the bigger ramifications of cinema, and definitely blockbuster cinema, can be, yeah, can definitely be traced back to him.
Yeah, even talk about The Godfather. It's like films, I think it's mentioned in the kind of Easy Rider's Raging Bull, where they kind of say like, a film had never done them numbers until that film came out. So it's like,
yeah.
And it's kind of, that kind of maybe put the stepping stones. So we got a Jaws, which then put the stepping stones. So we got Star Wars. And it's like, yeah, we could talk about this for hours, but let's not. So let me ask you, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
No, that would be the Baldwins. So you've got Alec, yep. Billy, Stephen, and the other one. You know, to quote that that thing from South Park, the movie, what's the worst thing about being a Baldwin? Nothing. I think, yeah, in seriousness, I think obviously, as you've uncovered, the Coppolas definitely seem to be one of the, you know, widest reaching families in cinema, and the most varied. So I'd have to say, yeah, they're probably, in terms of talent in front and behind the camera, so you do have a lot of acting families, like, you know the Sheens and stuff, and I'm trying to think of, obviously, yeah, you have the Baldwins, but in terms of, I say, talent across, you know, behind and in front of the camera, I think it's gonna be hard to top the Coppolas.
Yeah, I think I've kind of like set up a very impossible question with that one, because I've given a family where it's like, they do everything. Do you know what I mean?
They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're very much like, they've monopolized Hollywood in a way where it's like,
it's like a secret society. They've embedded themselves in everywhere. Actually, I am also a Coppola.
That's going to be the big reveal at the end. I'll pull off my face in a kind of Mission Impossible-esque fashion, and I will be Francis Ford Coppola underneath.
Well, I was going to say, is instead of, you know, like in the Marvel, instead of you know, Hail Hydra, it's going to be Hail Coppola.
Yeah, I'm going to be like a Coppola Skrull at the end. I'm just going to transform into one of them. Perfect. And I guess what I'm trying to really figure out by doing this podcast is, you mentioned it's one of your favorite films. What does Bill Murray say to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
Now, that is a very tough one, and I was thinking about this, and I'm pretty sure he says, I hear the Avengers is going to be awesome.
I love it.
The other line I was trying to think of is that, is it Scarlett Johansson's boyfriend in that? Is it Giovanni Ribisi? Mm-hmm. He's definitely punching very, very high in that film. So it'd be something along those lines of like, he's a very lucky man.
Perfect. That's an amazing answer. George, again, before I let you go, can you tell us where people can find yourself and Retro Ramble online?
Yeah, so Retro Ramble should be available on all good and bad podcast apps and services. You can even listen to it. We do have a website, retroramble.blog, so you can just listen to it through the website. But we're on Facebook. We've got a Facebook page. We're on Twitter, Instagram, though I don't post as much on Instagram. I say we're across sort of most social media, but yes, Retro Ramble, I say we're a monthly podcast, so check us out if you're interested in sort of 80s and 90s blockbuster and cult type movies.
I would very much I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring and saying if you're not listening to them, guys, make sure you listen to them right now. I recently listened to your Blade episode after kind of doing. I went down a rabbit hole of being like, I'm gonna watch all the Blade films, and then I'm like, yeah, like love the episode on that.
And then you got to the third one, I'm like, oh dear.
Yeah, I think I kind of did them in a day, and I fell asleep during the third one. I went, I'm not compelled in any way to pick that up and watch the rest of it. So I've seen
it's such a sharp drop after the first two. It's like they're great films, and then it just goes ooh. But yes, no, it was a lot of fun. Blade was one of those films that Charlie and I hadn't seen in a long time, so it was a lot of fun to go back and revisit that. And it's amazing how influential, you know, because it was pre-Matrix as mm-hmm. well. So like how influential, and before the whole Marvel machine that dominated cinemas and TV.
Well, George, thank you very much for coming along for this sea exploration adventure with me and making some Coppola connections.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been an absolute delight, and it's been a lot of fun talking about a very fun film. So yes, thanks for having me.
There we go, guys. A massive thanks for listening. And again, a massive thank you to George for coming on this sea exploration with me. As it's already been said, and I'll say it again, be sure that you do check out Retro Ramble. It is a fantastic dive into nostalgia and all things good. If you enjoyed this episode on The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, be sure to check out my podcast family. It's not a network, it's a family, cohorts over on the Pod Charles Cinecast, where they are currently doing a week by week swap over between Wes Anderson and Paul Thomas Anderson movies. They will be covering The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, probably in much more detail in a few weeks time, so be sure to check that out, as well as all the other great stuff they're doing. As for next week on the podcast, I'll be joined by the other McGee brother, Charlie, to talk about Spike Jonze's 1999 meta mind-bending comedy drama Being John Malkovich. As always, if you want to get in touch with the podcast, you can do that on all the socials. So that's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and Letterboxd, all at Caged In Pod. Or you can drop me an email, which I would love you to do, with a little voice note of what you think of any of the upcoming or previous films that we've covered on the podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this on right now. As always, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. So remember to keep it Coppola, and I'll be sure to catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharl Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.